Hey there, folks. This is Screen Watching. We're back. It's me, Dan Barra, and regular co-host, regular both in that he's often here and also eats lots of bran with his cereal, it's Simon Foster.
I do eat a lot of bran. It's good to be back, Dan Barrett. I've missed you. You've done a great job. Big shout out to Mel Campbell, who filled in a couple of weeks ago for me. She is terrific. And it's good to be back after my 2 and a bit weeks in Japan and Korea. Arigato. So had a great time. Have you been well? That's what's most important.
Well, I mean, clearly you haven't listened to the podcast. I've been horrendously unwell. But anyway, I'm back in the
saddle now. Yeah,
that
second one. Yeah, that second one was kind of coffee and splattery, but you did a good job getting through it. So good job, mate. You've held the fort. You've kept things afloat, and that's what I appreciate.
Yeah, indeed. So anyway, Simon Foster, we're going to dive right into a whole bunch of things. It's a pretty big week this week, but I wanted to start, before we get to our theme song, actually kickstart the podcast, there's three big bits of news. So let's go, you know, hit me with the first thing. What have we got here? What's going on?
Well, we're very excited here in Sydney because the IMAX theatre has returned. The IMAX format has relaunched here in Sydney with the opening of the mega theatre in Darling Harbour. They opened a couple of days. They opened midweek, I think, a Wednesday, with some retro screenings. They had Avatar, they had Top Gun, they had I know they've got the creator in there as well as for some late night stuff, but things are going to really rev up this week with the Taylor Swift Eras Tour film hitting the IMAX screen, as well as screens everywhere. So it's a huge week for Sydney goers who love their biggest of big screens. I think technically it's a little bit less than Melbourne, but still in sort of the top 10% of really big IMAX screens around the world. So it's a big screen.
Oh, so it's much smaller than it was then, because the Sydney screen previously was bigger than the Melbourne screen.
Yes, I think it's something like 30 square meters smaller than it originally was. Plus the original IMAX theater was that really tiered, like really tight, terrifying sort of seat structure, which was almost straight up and down. This one is a more sort of VMAX style, traditional style cinema seating.
Lost
so it's
me.
A bit flatter.
I love that thing where you just press right up against the screen. I thought that was fantastic.
I also love that as well, but it murdered my vertigo. I used to hate sort of taking my seat. I'd be shivering and shaking and gripping people as I walked past them because it was terrifying to walk around.
The problem is you're soft. I find it interesting, the idea that, you know, Sydney suddenly gripped with enthusiasm for this, considering that in the ye oldie days of it, around in the last couple of years, that IMAX theatre, I would find nobody there. Nobody.
Yeah, those last couple of years when there wasn't. I mean, it had some big movies. They put all the Batmans through there, and they had the Avatar. Yeah. So they had some huge movies back in the day. But yeah, in those last couple of years when it was just repeating all those whale documentaries and the Penguins of Patagonia sort of stuff, then it was pretty quiet. It was a pretty quiet sight.
No, but like. Even so, Simon, like, you know, they'd have like the big release movie of the week. So, I mean, I remember seeing like the Star Wars Force Awakens in there and all that kind of thing.
Not
and
sure.
Those films would get out like the big audiences for those first couple of days. But just like standard big release movies, things like Interstellar, I remember going in there on like a opening sort of 1 or 2 or 3 days. And like that thing was just a ghost town.
Mm. Yeah, I'm keen to see if it plays. I mean, it didn't have a big, maybe I just missed the invite. It's hard to believe I wouldn't be invited to a red carpet, but maybe I just missed the invite. But it didn't have a big opening sort of thing where all the C-listers and all the influencers were called to it. So maybe they're sort of soft launching it, but maybe they're going to, like, well, see if the, I mean, I'm sure it will, the Taylor Swift doco plays to big numbers for the first few days anyway, but... I'm looking forward to getting down there.
A venue like that, I think, is built for that Taylor Swift concert.
And for sure.
It got me thinking, one of the functions of that new dome that they've built in Las Vegas is that it plays movies. So at the moment, if you're not seeing U2 playing there, there's a Darren Aronofsky film that's been made explicitly for the dome. But I can't help but feel that as they start rolling these domes out around the world, so the plan is they want about 12 of these domes across the planet. I'm sure that one of those domes would probably end up landing in Sydney somewhere, Sydney or Melbourne. That's usually how it goes. And like something like a Taylor Swift event, Era event screening type thing, that would be absolutely, you know, sold out for months.
Huge. It would be huge. Yeah. I've got my Tay-Tay tickets. I've got my tickets for 2:15 tomorrow. I booked them. I'm actually paying for a movie ticket, which is not like me at all. And I did all that before I realized it ran for 2 hours and 48 minutes. So, kids, settle in. Don't have that big coat because you're rust out and you might miss Shake It Off. But
look, I'm going to
rush out. Make sure you shake it off.
I'm going to put the opposite advisor in there and say, kids, just know that it's not the full concert, which airs for 3 hours 15. Instead, it's a cut down version. But anyway, Simon.
You're a spoiler.
Oh, I'm just, you know, telling people just so they're not disappointed when they don't get the entire set list.
You're caring for the kids, and that's what's really important.
That's what I've always been about. Simon, very quickly, I just wanted to talk about the actor strike negotiation, which is comes to a standstill, means that strike action continues and nothing's going back into production for quite some time. And if they don't get started in finding resolutions this and next week or two, that's probably it for production for the end of the year. So, you know, not great. But
what a mess.
Here's what I just wanted to throw my two cents in. There's obviously like a number of things that are going backwards and forwards over negotiating. I would say the only thing that I would, if I was the Screen Actors Guild, the only thing that I absolutely would not back down on is the idea of having control over digital twins and stopping AI creation of it's my concern isn't so much like your lead actor in, you know, Fast and Furious 25. Like, I'm not concerned about that. Where I think the issue is for the Screen Actors Guild, for the industry as a whole, is the actual work of acting, which is not the day players. It's not really a thing. It's a lot of the additional actors, so a lot of background actors. Like, those are the guys that will be very, very quickly replaced by AI. Like, it just sort of seems to me that, you know, this year, next year, you're probably not seeing that happen, but the technology's there, falling into place, where eventually you're going to have like 4 or 5 actors hired for a movie and a cast of thousands, and that cast of thousands signed away their rights a couple of years ago. And chances are those people probably weren't even actors. They were probably people that were just hired for, you know, 2 to 3 days work. Just, you know, the accountant who does a bit of stand-up comedy on the weekend just gets hired to give away his likeness. And for years, he's appearing in the background. The same way that for years people were hearing like Wilhelm screams and other sound effects and audiences in like, you know, a lot of the laugh tracks you'd hear in sitcoms for years and years were recorded from like the Isle of Lucy days and just replayed through for, you'd hear dead people laughing in sitcoms as people are sweetening the sounds. That's the kind of work. And so I think that's the thing they really need to hold their feet to the fire on, make sure that the digital twin is protected.
It's really the fact that it's stalled again in the negotiations, and that this is becoming a real sticking point, which just shows how important it is to the acting community and the creative community. And it's boy, if there's no shifting of opinions, this, you're absolutely right. This strike could go on for ad infinitum.
The thing is like
a terrifying thing.
It's the AI that I think is quite literally what they're going to be holding the actors to. So, with the writers, I don't think that was as much of a concern. If anyone's actually used AI, you'll find that the writing isn't really quite right. And there's definitely disconnect between, and look, the technology is going to get better. It's not like I'm naive about that. But there's something about the creativity that goes into creating a script that's really quite different to AI generating it, because it is generative. But the thing is that the majority of acting work is, and I'm, again, not talking about the people that are right there smack bang in front of the camera that you're paying attention to. A lot of it's that background work that is not necessarily as heavily dependent on the performance of the day. Instead, it's really about filling a body and just being a presence. Like, that's the sort of work that I think would be really easily replaced. And so that's where the real concern is here, I think.
Scary times. And there's no end date as of the last sort of developments. There's no sort of, they're literally just saying, nope, we're stepping away from the table for a while. You guys take a deep breath and we'll come back later. So there's no dates attached to it as yet.
That's right. So we're probably looking at least another 1 or 2 weeks before anyone even considers sitting back at a table.
Wow. Okay. All right. Well, let's talk movies and TV shows.
Indeed. Well, we probably should go to our opening titles.
This is not like TV, only better.
Television! Teacher! Mother!
Secret lover.
What, that's it? That's your movie?
Well, I said that I had an idea for a movie.
All Okay, Simon, big show. We're going to talk about the highly anticipated Frasier return, which the first two episodes are streaming now on Paramount Plus. You're going to look at two Australian movies. There's Love Is in the Air, which I've seen some of your commentary around this, and my jaw hit the ground. And then there's another film called Shader. And also, I'm going to do a little quick grab bag of just a few things that are floating around at the moment. And then we're going to do an intermission where we're going to do a deep dive into the lost form of the sitcom. Lots of reviews around Frasier. Actually, you know what? I'll talk about that during the Frasier review.
Yeah,
Simon, big show. Let's just dive right in.
It stinks.
For about 30 years, Simon, Kelsey Grammer has been playing the role of Frasier Crane, which I just think is incredible. Character started in Cheers. The show started in, was it 82? And he came into it in season 3. So that's about 84. So it's probably 29 years, technically, give or take a few months. But here we are in 2023, a brand new Frasier Crane TV show. They've called it Frasier.
What is it about the city of Boston that leads me to forego the more sophisticated temptation of the fermented grape? Sitting here with a cold brew in my hand, I feel amalgamated with the hoi polloi.
You are the classic everyman.
Freddy! Surprise!
Dad! You're at my door, unannounced.
Now, there's a shorter way to say that. Surprise!
What's going on with your son?
I wish I knew. Got a girlfriend I've never even heard of. When I told him I wanted to spend more time with him, he said no.
This is not a good time.
Have you considered that he hates you?
Okay, Simon, the big problem with this show is it is called Frasier.
Please explain.
Okay, so you've got this character, Frasier Crane, appears in Cheers. He's part of the ensemble. Immediately from the very first episode, he's a presence on screen. He's probably not necessarily getting a huge number of laughs in that first episode more than any other guest star. But you could see that within the first 2 to 3 episodes, what that character did for Cheers, and this reverberates through to the modern day show, is he really lent heavily into what Cheers was great at, which is this idea of low culture and high culture being smashed together and being forced to confront each other. So
creating
Cheers,
conflict, and that's where the comedy comes from. That was classic. It was classic TV comedy.
Yeah. I mean, it wasn't even really conflict as much as maybe tension is probably the slightly better word.
Yeah, tension's a good word.
So in Cheers, obviously, you had the Sam and Diane relationship, which that was the core of the program, and that was very much about a lower-class guy culturally and a woman that perceived herself as, you know, being sort of very much of the upper-class taste, coming together, forming a romance. But while that was happening, the addition of the Frasier Crane character kind of further embeds this in, because up until that point, the Shelley Long character of Diane Chambers, she's kind of an island. So she's the one bit of class in the world surrounded by like an entire sort of suite of people who revel in low culture, or as they see it, culture. By introducing Kelsey, by the Frasier Crane character, you suddenly have like the sort of bench of characters that are interested in sort of high culture, just a little bit sort of stronger. So you get like that greater bit of tension happening within the series. As the Shelley Long character leaves the show, they kind of bump up the love interest character, soon-to-be wife character of Frasier Crane, Lilith Crane, or Lilith Stern, as she was originally in the show. And she provides that same function of she's a high culture person sort of operating in a world of lower class, Bostonians.
Yeah.
So you've got that. You spin Frasier off into his own character, and they maintain that tension throughout that series. It's very much about Frasier Crane. You meet his father, who admittedly in Cheers, they'd said that he died a number of years ago. So, you know, just kind of have to wash over that a little bit. But in this one, you've got that stronger sort of high culture of Frasier Crane, who's now leading the program. His brother Niles, also that sort of high culture background. Okay, but then that's juxtaposed against that sort of lower culture, everyday man character of Frasier's father. And so you've got that sort of, and here's where it actually becomes sort of proper tension, okay, where there's actual real stakes. It's not just people that you're hanging out with at a bar who are friends. Instead, you've actually got some family or familial relationships there with both Frasier and Niles. And so they are locked in with this guy. Like, he is part of their world as much as, you know, they may try to fight it at times.
And also increasingly the relationship he has with the public through his TV, through his radio show as well, because they were, it was considered a lower sort of form of entertainment at the time, and that talk back radio environment
that
provided.
Not so much. Not so much that it was a lower form of entertainment, and this was where the tension between Frasier and Niles sort of plays a role. Frasier, because he's kind of got a bit of an everyman streak to him, as we've seen develop through Cheers. As he comes into Frasier, it wasn't so much that radio was beneath him culturally as much as it was beneath him as a pop psychologist on the air. It demeaned the profession that both of them saw as such a lofty concept. Said. Yeah, yep. So you've got that high and low battle taking place within that. And then all the other supporting characters in there kind of straddle the two. So, I mean, like your Roz character is a bit of a lower class person culturally, but also can straddle that sort of high class. Like she's not actually as sort of, it's not as extreme. And probably the she's same smart. Thing for the Daphne yeah, Moon exactly. character as well. Yeah, both smart, educated people. Daphne's certainly a little bit kooky with the way that, you know, she can, you know, see futures and whatnot.
Observe, yes.
Yeah. But, like, she's not, like, a dumb person either. Like, they just kind of are maybe more in tune with sort of what's perceived as lower class. So you've got those tensions all in place that carries through. So what we've got with this new show is that, and this is the weird thing with the new show, it kind of feels as though the third show took place and we just never quite saw it. So you actually see a flashback in episode 3 of this Frasier revival to what Frasier was up to in the years between the original Frasier program and the new Frasier program we're seeing, where he hosted you see that he hosted this Dr. Phil style show, which again feels like an extension of that radio pop psychology. Yes. And it starts with the loftiest of ideals, where you could see this is the sort of show which Niles would be very supportive of as being a TV version of psychology. But then you see like flash forwards as they go through a couple of years of the program and it becomes bigger and broader and it resembles more like a Jerry Springer psychology program than it was a, you know, yeah. So that's pretty fun. But it does feel like there's a show that's been missing in between, which is a weird sort of thing for the Frasier Crane character. But... Okay. What you do have with this new show is that because they've called it Frasier 2023, there's a lot of expectation that it's going to be replicating Frasier, that it's a reboot of Frasier. And it's not that. It's an entirely third generation of the Frasier character, or fourth, technically. Well, you know, if you kind of think about it, there's the missing show in between it.
Yeah.
And so what you're seeing here is it's just Frasier introduced into a new program. The problem with the new program is that it's not quite as sharp as Cheers was and not quite as sharp as Frasier was. And look, real talk, Frasier was never as sharp as Cheers. But anyway, I'm just putting that out there. It's not as sharp as either of the previous two. Instead, what it is, it's just a quite good version of a generic sitcom from what we were seeing in like the 90s before the format kind of all fell apart. And
is
so
that work against it.
Well, this is exactly it. So you look at the reviews for this program and you're seeing a lot of folks who are just dismissing it entirely, and they're dismissing it for a couple of reasons. One, it's not Frasier, the original show, and it's not as good as the original Frasier program. Okay. Mm. On top of that as well, we don't watch sitcoms anymore. It is a format that is just the last one to really have any success was The Big Bang Theory, and that ended about like 5 or 6 years ago now. Okay, and that was a relic at the time. Since then, we haven't really seen sitcoms, and so people are now being forced to confront a show which they're seeing as a reboot of a beloved show from the 90s going into the early 2000s, and couple that with the fact that it feels very much like a 1990s sitcom in so many ways. And so I feel that there is a high-class, low-class approach that a lot of critics are taking to this program, where we're approaching it from a high-class perspective, but it's actually a lower culture product, which isn't to say it's a bad thing. So let me just sort of run through the premise of it, and then we'll go into some other thoughts.
Yeah, premise of it, okay, basically, I've got a few thoughts on this. Okay, let's have a listen.
Yeah, so... premise of it, basically, Frasier, he's decided to move back to Boston, and what we have in his first episode, it's a premise pilot. He wasn't going to come back to live in Boston. He was just stopping by to see his son, and then suddenly gets locked into the world, and so, you know, we've got Frasier deciding to move his life back to Boston. Part of it is he wants to, like, reunite with his son, who they haven't really had much of a connection for the last couple of years. Plot twist, the son has become a firefighter, much like how his grandfather worked for the fire service.
Yes.
Okay. And he's a bit of a lower culture person. And so there's tension between the father and son in the same way that in the previous show, there was tension between the son and the father. Yeah.
Interesting.
See, echoes.
That's clever.
You've got that. You've got Frasier. He has a job offer to go and work for a little place called Harvard, where he decides he's going to go off and do that. So that sort of gives him a job and a life away from, you know, his family. His son is in a relationships of sorts with a woman, and there's mystery in that first episode as to what that relationship is, but you find out at the end, I'm just going to spoil it for you now, okay, which is, it's not a romantic relationship, rather her ex-partner had been a firefighter who died in the course of action. After he had died, like, she'd given birth to their son, and so he felt an obligation to, you know, help that family and help, like, an old friend, you know, the duties that he really should have been doing. So you've got that relationship. Frasier, because he's crazy wealthy because of the whole Dr. Phil-style psychology program, he buys out the entire building, buys an apartment for him and Freddie to live in across the hall from where Freddie had been living with the girl. And so she now lives across the hall from her with a cute baby who thankfully isn't really incorporated that much into it. Okay, but there's a few nice moments. But it's basically Freddie and Frasier across the hall that are there. And so she occupies a bit of a Roz type of a role in their relationship.
Sounding very familiar. This is sounding very safe, sitcom-y sort of couch in the middle of the set kind of feel to it.
And that's 100% what it is. It is a traditional sitcom. And then you've got the work relationship as well, where there's a high-class professor who's very much a Niles type of a figure of sorts, but he's also a bit more British and a bit more snooty. And then you've got like the woman that runs the department who is probably less defined than the others in terms of exactly who she is and where that sort of class stature comes from. But there's one final character, Simon, who is, I think, the absolute masterstroke of incorporating this character in here, and it is the son of Niles and Daphne, creating a further generation again down. And the thing is, this son is very much his father's son. Okay. It is Yeah. It's a 19-year-old kid who is going to university for the first time at Harvard. And so you've got like that sort of connection there. And that's why he's there with Frasier. And he's very Niles in so many ways, but he's very much finding his place in the world. So it's basically Niles 15 years younger than when we first met him.
So let me just say there's, Cheers was and grew into such a perfectly defined group of characters from the, you know,
From that phrase, here's where this show falls down and against Frasier and Cheers. Cheers, from that very first episode, when you watch it, it completely nails and defines it from the first episode. Okay. Mm-hmm. There is no, you watch the first episode of Cheers and watch an episode like three seasons in, the only difference is that maybe Cliff Clavin's character is introduced a little bit more into it and Frasier's introduced the show, but none of the characters are any further defined because they're all really clearly there from the first episode.
In all fairness, it was a high watermark to start with. Not a lot of sitcoms hit the ground running like Cheers did. And even the great Seinfelds and all that sort of stuff, they develop into their best versions of themselves.
100%.
Is Frasier this 2023 destined for that, holds that sort of potential?
I mean, that's the question, and this is kind of what I wanted to get to. I don't know. I don't think it can, because I don't think we watch sitcoms in the same way, and TV is different. This is for a streaming service. It's not going to have more than 10 episodes a season, because don't forget, the way that we used to watch sitcoms was you'd watch the first episode, which would always be a overwrought premise pilot where they set up what the parameters of the show is. And then you'd get to know who the characters are over the next like 5 to 8 episodes. And it's not just you as an audience getting to know who the characters are. The writers are finding what works with the characters and getting their way through. And so it'd usually be by mid-season that the show is really just firing on all guns and it's going. You mentioned Seinfeld. The first season of Seinfeld is just a collection of 4 episodes. They don't, like, it jumps tone like every episode. It's all over the place. Second season kind of narrows in on that tone a little bit more. And it's only by the end of the second season that it starts to almost resemble the program that we really know it to be. And it's third season onwards. But second season's, again, like only, 7 or 8 episodes, I think. It's not that many. So it's kind of, if you think about that idea of halfway through a season's where it starts working, that's the case for Seinfeld. Frasier had the benefit of coming right off the back of Cheers with most of that same writing cast, kind of knowing who the character was. So, like, they've kind of got, like, they hit the ground running on that one in a way that few sitcoms really do. So, again, like, as you're saying, very few sitcoms, almost no sitcoms, have as strong a pilot episode as that Cheers pilot did, okay? Carry that through to Frasier, which almost matches that Cheers pilot in being as immediately grounded and set from the outset. And then you've got the Frasier show, and, like, just statistically, it can't do it a third time. And they've got the disadvantage of not following the previous sitcom carrying through. There is, what was it, 2004 Frasier finished. So like 19 years in between.
All right. So to wrap this up, in your opinion, and you've watched a handful of episodes now, on which side of the scale does it waver from interesting creative endeavor with potential to ugly IP regurgitation?
Neither. I've seen five episodes. It straddles as being a perfectly good, fairly average sitcom. The test for whether or not the show is good is you've watched an episode. In the days between you and possibly watching next episode, do you miss the characters and do you kind of want to go and spend some more time with them? And the answer I found with this show was I absolutely miss the characters. And I've seen five episodes now. I'm going to have to wait 3 weeks until there's new episodes of the show for me to be able to see. I'm like going to be hurting. I want to hang out with these guys again.
That's good. Well, that's a fairly upbeat take on what could have been ugly IP regurgitation, but it's not. So that's interesting. All right. Yeah. It's Frasier. Where do we watch it?
That is on Paramount Plus, where you can also watch the Superior Cheers and I presume also the original Frasier series. Also Superior, cool. But you know. Yeah.
All right. Let's head to the big screen. I've got a couple of very different Aussie picks to review.
Well, how about you introduce the first one and then we can play a clip, Simon? I mean, I know you've been away, but yeah.
I've forgotten the whole format already. what was your name again? okay, so Love is in the Air on Netflix is the first one. Play clip.
Fullerton Airways, reading you loud and clear.
Fullerton Airways, if we were to sell, we would wipe the debt off our books.
Take care of it.
They're sending someone to do an inspection.
William.
Dana.
You must be Mr. Randall's assistant.
Chief pilot, actually.
Oh.
Strap in.
Sorry, I don't know where to put my hands, so I'm going to touch something.
Just put your hands down.
Okay, so there was a whole lot of fuss and bother coming out of the Netflix team when Love is in the Air became a huge hit around the world. This new little sweet Aussie rom-com starring our own Delta Goodwin took the world by storm, apparently, in its first week of release and was watched in a whole lot of places by a whole lot of people. Good, I'm glad. Australian rom-com contemporary film making its mark around the world very briefly, and believe me, the plot is very brief. It is the story of a family-run tropical airline overseen by Roy Billing, the great Roy Billing. He's a fantastic actor. Steph Tisdale is in there providing a lot of laughs as well, but the main star is Delta Goodrum. She's a feisty pilot who doesn't really care that the business is slowly going under. She's much rather serve the communities of the tropical islands around Queensland and the Pacific, and she does it with a great deal of grace and a great deal of movie star charm. She's very good in the lead. There is a slight problem in that the British company, which owns the majority share in this small family airline, doesn't like the way the books are looking, so they send Joshua Sass. I think it's pronounced Joshua Sass. I probably should check that before I go.
Joshua Software as a Service.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know what that means. Who starred in the TV series Gallivant. He is sent out from the UK to sort of very quietly close this business down before it costs the British owners any more money. But what he finds is that, A, the people of tropical North Queensland are utterly charming and beautiful and personified by Delta Goodrum, who is who's very sweet and has a great chemistry with Joshua. What you expect will happen in this completely happens, but it happens with a great deal of joie de vivre and a lot of beautiful locations around sunny F&Q. So does it deserve the success that it's having everywhere? Yes, it does. The main thing that I took out of this was that while it's not a particularly creatively ambitious film, it is something that completely understands the genre and the audience to which it's working. And in that regard, it nails the premise. And there's a whole lot of people who say that our funding bodies shouldn't be making, you know, kitchen sink miserabilism like the Australian industry is known for, or arty films, which, as fantastic as they are, don't find any sort of mainstream audience. Every now and then we do need a Love is in the Air to come along, recharge the batteries, introduce or reintroduce, I guess, a star like Delta Goodrum and what she can do on screen, and just sort of say, hey, we can make a little fun, sweet, colourful movie as well that is finding an audience on its streaming platform, which is exactly where this belongs. Let's not have too many delusions of grandeur. This isn't a big screen film. It very much belongs on the small screen, but it does so with a whole lot of lovable charm to it. So, yeah, I'm going to err on the side of good on them for getting this right. If you don't aim too high, sometimes it's not a bad thing. You get what you get with Love is in the Air, and it's proving popular around the world. So, having said all of that, let's move to another new Australian.
Oh, sorry.
Do you have thoughts? I should open this up for conversation.
You should. Delta Goodrum is the blandest human being on the planet. There is no way I'll be watching this.
There's the point. You haven't watched it. I'm not going to say that I am a huge Delta Goodrum fan. Or good luck to her because of the success she's had. But I was surprised by what a convincing leading lady she was in this. So I'll answer it in that regard. But yes, valid point. Go ahead.
Look, also I'd say that yours is the only positive comment I've heard from it. Look, it's basically been really heavily panned. And also, I don't know, it's been that successful. Both the number of reviews from professional critics on Rotten Tomatoes and the audience score, both incredibly low in volume, which makes me suspect that not many people are actually press play on this one. But you take your perception on this one and go for it.
Oh, I'm taking it, baby.
I mean, I will say audience score on Rotten Tomatoes, less than 50 people have rated it, which is, I've never seen that mark on Rotten Tomatoes.
You're getting snarky. I love Delta. Okay, anyway, fine. All right, good. Yes, oh, look, I'm totally in the air. This is not a film that lends itself to critical sort of appraisal or a deep dive into why it works or why it doesn't work. This is just exactly what it is. It's all up there on the screen. I think it works a charm for
also,
audiences who don't see enough of the Australian industry making these sort of films.
You used an acronym during your talk then, which, I mean, it's a perfectly valid acronym to use, but I've never actually heard it said out loud. And I think there needs to be a moratorium on it being said out loud. FNQ, which obviously stands for Far North Queensland, commonly accepted acronym around the Australian world. But when you say it as quickly as you did, it's like FNQ. And it's like, what's wrong with Q? Why is it such a bad thing? Sorry, Simon, this is the second film. Let's go.
Yes, let's have a quick look at the a scene from the new film, Shader.
Lara, this is Shader. She's here with her daughter, Mona.
And was like, what does that mean?
Who is Shader?
By whom name you choose her?
The judge has issued Hossein temporary access.
I don't understand.
It means Hossein can see Mona alone, unsupervised.
I have just returned from 3 and a bit days at the Busan International Film Festival. Ended off my trip with a little bit of a travel brag there. But the only Australian film playing in the incredible lineup was this movie called Shader. It is the story of a young Iranian mother and a six-year-old daughter. It's all set in 1995. And they find a refuge in an Australian women's shelter during 2 weeks of the Iranian New Year, otherwise known as Nowruz, and all the while the shadow of the abusive father figure in their life, her husband, sort of hangs over them, and she is trying to rebuild her life in very small incremental steps while he is still on the scene. A judge grants him access to their young daughter for visitation periods, but each one of those visitation periods brings with it incredible anxiety and tension as to whether he's going to take the daughter and run off. And they have to actually coach the daughter into recognizing airport police officials, so if the father does try to abduct the young girl, she'll know what to do and run to the man in blue to save her. This is a very understated but very potent and powerful film with the incredible Zaa Amir Abrahimi in the lead as Shader. She's in every scene in this film, a beautiful, talented actress who brings with her this incredibly tangible sense of anxiety and fear. Basically a fear that she lives with, that the husband is going to, played by Osama Sami, is going to impact her life in such a terrible way. It is a snapshot of a woman who's in decline, who's in struggling with her own mental anguish, but who is determined to sort of win out in the end against this brutal patriarchal force who offers abuse, both physical and mental, at every turn, which sounds depressing and challenging to watch in the extreme, and at times it is, but it's also an incredibly uplifting story of a woman and her young daughter finding community with a bunch of other abused and disturbed women and just coming out on top. So already getting some of the best reviews of the year for an Australian film. I would say that Zaha Amir Ibrahimi is a front runner for the Best Australian Actress Award at the next actor ceremony. And the cast is strong throughout. Leah Purcell. And I'm just trying to find who plays the young girl. She's just terrific. I can't, doesn't matter. But yeah, terrific film, Shader, representing Australian cinema around the world, certainly at the Busan Film Festival and in cinemas now, definitely worth a look.
Okay, so I was hoping to dig up the name of the daughter just then. And is it Lucinda Armstrong? Is the character Renee?
Yes, I think it is.
Yeah, Lucinda Armstrong Hall is the actor's name.
Yeah.
No. Best known for appearing in Neighbours from as the character Holly Hoyland.
I don't think that's her. No, that's one of the other abused women in the.
Yeah, no, I don't. The age isn't right at all.
She's on not on here. But it's the cast, top to bottom, is terrific and features some amazingly tender moments on screen. So definitely worth having a look at for good issues based Australian cinema. The anti love is in the air, as you might say.
Okay, well, this one I might watch. Simon Foster, this is the time of the podcast where we dive right into the intermission.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's intermission time.
So, Simon, I feel that we've already flirted with the topic here as we discussed Frasier, but look, here's the thing with Frasier. As I said, it's a very generic mid-90s style sitcom. And I think I referred to it in the review that I posted to the Always Be Watching newsletter. Basically, this show kind of feels as though there was a alternate reality we all slipped into where 90s style sitcoms just continued being made into the 2000s and streaming television never really happened and broadcast TV just kept on being a thing. And if you think about the idea of... But if you just think about the idea that these shows just kept on being made, then at a certain point, you just reach Frasier. Like, it just kind of feels as though it's just the current version of one of those programs. And that's why it feels like such an anachronism. But it got me thinking, what were those sitcoms from years gone by that we really liked? Because here's the thing. When we talk about sitcoms, and you did this when you were talking about just like reaching for an example, you grabbed Seinfeld. We talked about Cheers in that. Okay, we talked about Frasier, and if we talk broadly about sitcoms, we'd probably also mention something like, say, Friends, for example, as part of the mix. We might, as we dive into the 80s, start looking at things like maybe sort of Family Ties, or in the 70s, maybe sort of going into like your Happy Days, your Mork and Mindy's, your Mary Tyler Moore Show, Rhoda, Newhart. Like, there's the accepted canon of like great shows. But the thing is that when we're watching TV programs sort of within a culture, we're not necessarily always just watching the best things. We're relating to shows that are just kind of on. Some of these programs we connect with in a way which is just what you do when you're looking for entertainment. Okay. And so I figured there's a whole bunch of these TV programs out there, which we just really loved and enjoyed, because here's the secret of the sitcom. As great as a lot of those other sitcoms I mentioned were, and as much as they were the shows that everyone latched onto at the time, what works about the sitcom isn't that you're watching necessarily the finest of comedy and that there's the best comedic performers, but really it's kind of just this thing that you want to hang out with. It's kind of entertainment for entertainment's sake. And I don't think there's a problem with that.
You introduced me to that term, the hangout comedy. I never sort of considered sitcoms to be that, but you brought it up early in the podcast, and it's something that's completely true. You just want to hang out for a week with your favorite people on television, and that's what a hangout comedy does so well.
Yeah, and like sitcoms, the best sitcoms generally are a hangout of sorts. And yes, the sitcoms evolved beyond like having the laugh track and the multi-camera to things like The Office, but The Office was still just a hangout. Like, you still just want to hang out with your friends at Dunder Mifflin for 30 minutes and get on with it.
Sure.
But anyway, Simon.
So where are we going with the intermission?
Well, yeah. So I asked you to sort of come up with three, but I know that we're going to start with three and it's just going to grow out into being a bigger list. So
no, it's not.
Okay. Well, I mean, maybe not, but you know, we'll see how it goes. So I thought I'd think through some of the sitcoms that meant a lot to me as a kid growing up through the 80s and going into the 90s as a teenager, sort of finding my way in the world. And the thing is that the sitcom is very much a product of broadcast television. I don't think it necessarily works on streaming. We can go back and watch older sitcoms on streaming, but they're not natively of streaming. And so that's kind of where I think the new Frasier show falls into a little bit of trouble. And sorry, Simon, one very quick thought. The reason why I don't think they work on streaming is because the nature of the generic comedy should be that you're hanging out with them for half an hour, but streaming encourages you to want to watch it for, you know, three or four episodes back to back. It kind of violates the relationship we have the program that way.
Totally agree. And also, I think with this middle section is that we're not necessarily going to jump straight to the Cheers and the Seinfelds and the hugely popular shows that really define our generation or who we are. These are the shows that we just kind of like that maybe have disappeared and don't. A lot of people maybe don't know them, but that we remember fondly for that very reason, that they're good hangout shows.
100%. So look, I'm going to throw just a couple of titles out there. And look, let's see if you even remember some of these.
This will be
okay. So like, here's the thing. So throughout my life, there are a couple of shows which sort of dominated, and these are some of the obvious ones. So, you know, you've got your Seinfeld, your Cheers, your Frasier's, whatever, Roseanne, Golden Girls, Family Ties, you know, all the easy ones. Murphy Brown, I watched a lot of as a kid. I've tried watching latter era Murphy Brown, actually not even latter era, like mid era Murphy Brown. It wasn't very good. Mm. So I do wonder if those early episodes are as good as I remember them being, but, you know, it is sort of what it is. And so there's another show as well, which this is more a generational thing. People slightly older than myself would know this as just being something which was part of the culture. But for me, it was a sitcom that was repeated at like 9:30 in the morning years after it had gone to air, which was the B. Arthur comedy Maud, which
of course,
I loved as a kid, which was weird because you watch that and it is not a kid-friendly TV program by any means.
I didn't think there'd be much in there for you as a kid, as a young Dan Barrett growing up in Sydney's West or wherever you grew up, Brisbane.
This was back when I was watching it on, it's not SAS, it's, I'm trying to think what the Channel 9 regional affiliate was in South Australia, which is where I grew up as a young kid.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
They had television? Wow. Okay. Well, so that's interesting.
There I was watching my cartoons, and then during school holidays, flipping over to watch a bit of Maud, probably watching the episodes Maud's Dilemma, where she went and got an abortion in a very special two-part episode. Yeah.
Very special.
Yeah.
Well, look, and you're right. That is a generational thing because I remember Maud as being a very prime time adult sort of look at, you know, coming out of that late 70s Norman Lear era of sitcoms where some fairly weighty issues were dealt with in a half-hour comedy format. So, yeah, it's to think of it as a 9:30 in the morning while Dan's sort of faking an illness to stay at home and watch Maud from school sort of film, sort of sitcom is unusual.
Absolutely. But, look, I sort of come of age in, like, that sort of early 1990s going into the mid-90s, which is when I think the sitcom kind of peaked in terms of volume and even the most generic sitcoms were still pretty good. Like there was nothing that was like truly just tremendously bad. I mean, there was, but you know.
There was.
Okay. So here's a couple of the titles that I was watching sort of through the 90s, and I'm just going to belt out a whole bunch of them and, you know, throw in any comments as time goes on. Okay. Almost Perfect. This was a sitcom that was set in a writer's room of a 90s cop show. This is from a couple of the writers of Cheers and has this great big band opening theme song, but it's ostensibly a romantic comedy between a TV showrunner who falls in love with a guy who's a cop.
Don't remember it. That's interesting. All right, I'll check that out.
Yeah. Played on Channel 7, I think, and this would have been, 95, 96-ish. Nancy Travis being the lead of the program.
Oh, vaguely, yes. Nancy Travis. Boy, she was of the era, wasn't she? Don't know what's happened to her, but yeah, love Nancy Travis.
She's still kind of around. She was in that last Tim Allen comedy, Last Man Standing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, of course she was.
Yeah.
I remember.
Definitely one of the last gasps at the sitcom. Yes. There was a show There was a show that, in the same way I used to watch it at 9:30 in the 80s watching Maud, in the 90s there was a show that lasted a couple of years of play on Channel 9 called Hope and Gloria,
mm-hmm.
which was two women running like a morning TV show, kind of like a Today program of sorts. Yeah.
That was the girl from Murphy Brown, wasn't it? Didn't she sort of roll into that?
Nope, you are thinking of the other one that was very similarly named. It might be a Hope and something else.
Okay, yep.
That's a different one, Faith, but ostensibly.
Faith, what was her name?
Faith Ford.
Faith Ford, yes.
Yeah, I can't remember the name of that one. Carolyn in the City, I think people kind of remember that one.
Sure, Leah Thompson.
The Single Guy, which was very much a post-Friends and Seinfeld effort to...
Was that Jonathan Silverman?
Yeah, Jonathan Silverman and Ernest Borgnine. Yes.
Funny guy.
Excuse me, the funniest thing you'll ever see is get onto YouTube and type in Ernest Borgnine, Fox News. Just sit back and enjoy. Lasts about a minute. Hilarious. You will never see anything funnier than that.
There's a tip. Okay. Kids. Yep, next one.
Yep. What have we got here? Love and War, which was an effort by a Murphy Brown creator, Diane English, to go and do a romantic comedy straight off the success of Murphy Brown. So she left Murphy Brown to go and do this show. It starred, what's her name? Was it Susan Day? I want to say Susan Day.
Oh, yes, Susan Day from L.A. Law.
Yeah. Yes. Or from the Partridge Family.
Partridge Family, yeah, of course. Yeah.
And also, oh gosh, I'm trying to think of the name of the guy, Jay Thomas. So Jay Thomas, yes. You'll know by face. He was in a season of Mork and Mindy and was recurring in Cheers for a few seasons. Ended up being fired from Cheers.
Oh, really? Oh, okay, yes.
I was going to say, got fired from Cheers because he made a radio appearance where he was somewhat derogatory towards the physical appearance of Cheers co-star Rhea Perlman and then suddenly found himself killed off on the program.
Jay, also quite famous for, and he's the late Jay Thomas. He passed away a few years ago, as I understand. Mm. But he used to come on Letterman's New Year's Eve show or Christmas show and try to throw the angel off the top of the Christmas tree with a football.
Yeah, absolutely.
Or ham or something. Wasn't it a ham or some sort of baked?
Oh, it would be a ham.
Top of a Christmas tree with a football, which he used to do annually. So yes, I remember Jay Thomas very well.
So that show, notable because Susan Day left after the first season to be replaced by Annie Potts, and so they continued it for another two seasons. But if you ever find an episode of that, the production style on it is really, really interesting in that it's set in a New York diner and like through the late hours of the night, okay? But, sorry, late hours of the night, that's not quite true. It's more sort of, it's not even quite a diner. It's kind of like just a, you know... like a sort of slightly more upmarket than a diner restaurant. So it's the sort of place where you'd kind of drop in like a diner sort of a thing, but there are people there having like sort of proper meals at the same time. But it's really bustling and there's so many extras in the background all walking around in front of the main group of characters who are sitting at the bar sort of diner type thing. But anyway, it kind of feels like you're in a bustling restaurant as the evening's going on. It's a really unique look and feel to it.
Nice. Yeah. Okay.
Moving on really quickly. I mentioned Golden Girls and Cheers, but something I thought was maybe worth mentioning was Sports Night, which is like this weird 90s, like it's an Aaron Sorkin series. It's his first TV program. But it's notable for the fact that when you watch it, there's these uncomfortable moments when you're watching it where there's a laugh track on it. Okay. But it's shot as like a standard sort of single camera comedy. And it comes from this period in the late 90s where there was this changeover happening where people were getting a bit more experimental, wanting to see some more single camera or half hour comedies up, but the audiences weren't really quite there for them yet. So there's a bunch of failed shows like that are very sort of similarly sort of structured at the time. And the format kind of became more popular about 5 or 6 years later. But Sports Night used to film two or three scenes in front of a live studio audience. So you'd get some genuine laughs and you'd see the actors playing to the audience. But as that first season goes on, it just leans more and more into being single camera. And so it reached this one point where midway through, they haven't had a laugh track for like about 16 minutes. And then suddenly there's like a bit of laughter that comes over this whole one episode.
Oh my Bizarre. God. What a creative decision that is. Wow. Who came up with that idea? All right. Okay. Yeah. Sports Night is a fave of mine that I haven't watched in many, many years. And I've actually got the American DVD box set somewhere in my cupboard back there. But yeah, I used to love Sports Night. Although it barely got a release out here. It was late night on Channel 9 or 10 or something.
Channel 7 used to play it at like ridiculous o'clock.
Yeah, it was crazy.
Yeah. Simon, what did you find for your little list there?
All right. Well, I kicked the first thing that came to mind when you put this intermission idea forward was a little show called Dream On, which I used to think was a terrific little concept for a show. It starred Brian Benben, who I know little of from the last 30 years, but he played a book.
Worth noting, co-star being sitcom legend Wendy Malick.
Wendy Malick, of course, and from the creators David Crane and Marta Kaufman, who went on to do Friends and a whole lot of big deal TV shows. But what I found really interesting about this one was whenever he had fantasies or sexual thoughts or came up with ideas in his mind, they used to cut to old black and white TV shows or movies to represent that. And some of those I remember being very, very funny, very, very cleverly done. I remember it went from being a kind of a saucy, a little bit kind of Married with Children type of comedy with some very saucy moments to being a bit more family friendly or being a bit more in the vein of sort of Tim Allen-y type of comedy. But either way, I used to love the way they dropped in these very funny use of old TV shows and movies in the black and white. So that was just one that seems to have disappeared. And I imagine would get stuck in some terrible rights issues with all these different clips playing it. Yeah, and turned up anyway since.
Yeah, my understanding with that program, and we got it here on Channel 10. I think we got a fairly edited version of it here in Australia. I don't know if you've seen it outside of just those Channel 10 screenings, but
I remember it being sort of a bit saucy at times. Yeah, but I also remember it being on at like 8 o'clock on a Wednesday evening or something. It used to be part of that block. Well, it used to be part of that block that was sort of, I remember watching X-Files and NYPD Blue, and I always think of Dream On as being in that sort of zone.
Yeah, it's because it was. So my memory of it was that mid-90s, they decided they'd move the X-Files to Wednesday nights at 8:30 from the Thursday 9:30 slots. And replacing the X-Files on that Thursday night, they tried doing an hour of The Larry Sanders Show and Dream On back-to-back.
That's right, yes.
And it did not take. But my understanding with Dream On was that...
I remember it as much watch TV, yeah.
Yeah. The version we got here of Dream On was a cut-down version. I believe the US version was a bit sexier and a bit saucier and may have had some nudity in it, which we certainly didn't get here in the Australian version. Now, I could be wrong on that nudity aspect, but I believe that's accurate.
All right. My next one is a show that was a big hit in its day, certainly in the US. I don't know how huge it was here, but WKRP in Cincinnati was a show that I used to just love. I thought it was a very clever workplace comedy. Sort of straddled that balance between conventional sitcom-y type laughs and giggles with a smarter sort of workplace vibe and also great character interactions. I thought that was a really clever there was some really clever casting, really clever writing in WKRP in Cincinnati. And you'll know better than I whether it was a big hit here in Australia. I don't think it ever achieved anything great here like it did in the US, but just thought it was a terrifically written piece of sort of ensemble comedy.
Yeah, I'm not really sure how it played here in Australia, to be completely honest. But I've seen like one or two episodes of it and it wasn't really particularly that strong, but I think it's just one of these things where it plays really well at the time. And then and sitcoms don't age well generally. So it's pretty rare to find a sitcom from back in the day that still holds, which is kind of why it's a miracle that shows like Mary Tyler Moore Show and Cheers still play as well as they do today.
Speaking about not aging well, I'm going to finish this off with this is going to cause a bit of a stink, but I'm going to finish this off with two British sitcoms that from the 70s that were primetime shows here in Australia that my family and a lot of families used to sit around and watch. These were big hit shows in their day. Love Thy Neighbor and Mind Your Language. Now, these are two shows which dealt with race issues, which dealt with social issues, class issues in the UK, used language which has long since been considered totally unsuitable, not only for television, but in general society, but also managed to, in hindsight, explore in a fairly frank way the tensions that exist between races and cultures in the English society. So Love Thy Neighbor, you just wouldn't get away with nowadays, but was smart in its own kind of broad way. And Mind Your Language was full of just some of the most, by today's standards, offensive stereotypes, maybe by standards back then too, offensive stereotypes, but played with that in a way that sort of offered a little bit of understanding of their cultures as well, in a very minor but kind of interesting way. So Love Thy Neighbor and Mind Your Language. No, we're not going to play any clips of them here on screen watching, but if you want to, do go and check them out on YouTube, where you will find them.
Okay, and also while at YouTube, Ernest Borgnine, Fox News.
And that's the intermission.
Seriously, play that clip. It's amazing. Yeah. Okay.
All right.
Simon, let's... Okay, we've got to get through this really quickly. Sorry, Scott.
Yep.
Things upstairs. Okay. Really quickly, Simon, what else have you been watching? My thing, super quickly, Moonlighting is available in the US again. I've been streaming that by my ways. Gosh, that show holds up so well in a way I hadn't quite expected.
It really does, because I haven't watched it since the day, but I'm looking forward to tuning into it over the next couple of days. I can't wait to see it.
Yeah. The first episode, it's got some very 80s pacing to the pilot episode, but anytime that Sybil and Bruce are on screen, suddenly the show, like, it is electric.
Interesting. All right, what have I been watching? Well, having been overseas, I dived into the world of in-flight movies, which was a very thrilling experience. I find in-flight movies like going to the drive-ins. It's a really fun way to watch your movies, but it's not a very good way to watch a movie. So I caught up with two of the big films from last year, or one of the big films and one of the ones I just missed. Fast X I watched, and boy, does that require as small a screen as possible to really get the full nuance out of the performances. Fast X played, and I also watched No Hard Feelings, the Jennifer Lawrence comedy, both of which were exactly what I thought they'd be, quite enjoyable. No Hard Feelings went to some sort of darker, more dramatic places than I expected it to, so that was a surprise, but both were exactly otherwise what I expected. This is a movie that you might be aware of, which I wasn't, called Maggie Moore, starring your movie husband, John Hamm. So, yeah, which
I'm waiting for this to get a local release, because I've been wanting to talk about this on a podcast for like months now.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I quite liked it. It's got sort of that small indie vibe about it, which was popular back in the 90s, and it co-stars Tina Fey, and they have some really nice scenes together. So, I thought it was pretty good. Pretty good.
Yeah, directed by John Slattery, who people know from Mad Men as well.
From the Mad Men, yeah. I watched this very bizarre, and I know I got some funny looks from my fellow passengers, called Unicorn Wars, which is a Spanish animated film. I actually tried to get it for my festival a couple of years ago, but it's an animated film that's really sort of a metaphor for the Franco dictatorship and the use of religion as a way to stir the masses and get things going angrily for sort of violent social change. But it stars teddy bears and unicorns in the roles of the two warring factions. So, and it's incredibly bloody and quite violent and just horrific. But it all stars teddy bears and unicorns. So that was pretty cool. And I watched a really compelling documentary from Oliver Stone called Nuclear Now, which sort of puts into perspective why nuclear energy is maybe, not even maybe, definitely the best option going forward in terms of mass energy production. So I'm very pro-nuclear now. Send your emails to Dan Barrett at screenwatchingpodcast.com.
Excellent. Okay, Simon, let's kick things off. Where else are we going here? We are heading straight to This Week in History.
This Week in History, October 15, 1959, which series premieres on US television, Dan Barrett, later becoming arguably the greatest TV to film adaptation ever?
Well, look, we know that Peter Gunn was in 1958, so this could only be The Untouchables.
It is The Untouchables. Well done, sir. October 17, 1962. What was particularly special about today's episode of People and Places, a local Manchester variety show on UK television?
Sorry, can I just go back to The Untouchables for a quick second?
I'd appreciate that.
In one of the rare moments that I do, I logged onto Facebook yesterday and it pushed me up a thing talking about, you know, what you did 10 years ago. It was a picture of me going to see The Untouchables at the movies. And I remember it being a really big moment because I drove all the way from Brisbane to Robina to see it, which is not a quick drive. It's like an hour, I think. Not huge either. You know, I'm not patting myself on the back too much. But I went and saw it thinking, when else would I ever get the chance to see this on a big screen? Because I'd never seen it on a big screen before then. Okay. And, you know, so was it 10 years ago? So that's 30 years between release to... That's not quite right. I don't know. Whatever.
Dan doing maths years. On the podcast. Anyway. I love it. Yep.
Never seen it on a big screen. But anyway, somehow in the 10 years since then, I've seen it like about 5 times on a big screen.
It is a well rolled over retro bit of programming, which I'm all for. I saw it 7 times at the movies, and it's, as I've mentioned previously on the podcast, it's one of our favorite movies. So
yeah,
I don't doubt that at all. Yeah.
Yeah. Love it. Sorry.
What was the next question?
Yeah. Read it again.
What was particularly special about today's episode of People and Places, a local Manchester variety show on UK television?
Not a clue.
First time the Beatles appeared on air on television.
Ah.
And October 20, 1967, I should say, at Bluff Creek in Northern California, Roger Patterson and Robert Gimlin capture a few frames of film that are viewed by millions around the world. What did they film?
Now, when I first read this on the rundown, I'm like, this is going to be something like UFO bullshit. And then I'm like, okay, wait, no, I actually know what this is. This is the time where a man put on a costume that made him look like he was some sort of a monkey-type creature. And people since then have been going, hey, look, there's a weird monkey-type creature that lives out in the woods.
You know, you could have just said they filmed Bigfoot and been done with it, but no, you had to get snarky. Anyway, doesn't matter. Yes, that was the Patterson-Gimlin film, the famous... captured footage of a real Bigfoot, and we'll leave it there. Birthday quiz.
He's not real.
No, not happy birthday. No, not that. Please, no, not happy birthday.
Okay, in this week's birthday quiz, October 16, 1958, Tim Robbins. October 17, 1947, Michael McKean. October 18, 1960, Jean-Claude Van Damme, and October 20, 1979, one John Krasinski. All these men, and sorry for it being male focus this week, but it's just the way it all turned out. What do these actors, they've all played a certain role in a certain type of production. What do they all have in common?
I really have no idea at all.
Yeah, I know. We came to this one late to the game. I apologize for that. The mockumentary format. Tim Robbins was in Bob Roberts, the great sort of political mockumentary. Michael McKean, of course, Spinal Tap and all the Christopher Guest comedies. Jean-Claude Van Damme has done a couple. He did a kind of mockumentary called JCVD back in 2008. He also starred in a very short-lived TV series called Jean-Claude Van Johnson in 2016, which he played himself.
It was a crime video show, yeah.
Yeah, it was. And October 20, 1979, John Krasinski, of course, starred in The Office, one of the great mockumentary format uses. So.
Here's the thing. You're going through the list, and I'm like, Krasinski, what mockumentary was he in? Sorry, yeah. Dumb
that,
moment, go
that
on.
Little show called The Office. Yeah, exactly right. And thus brings us to the end of screen watching.
Okay. Oh, yeah. Like, I spent some time going through their filmographies trying to find some links, and I was like, I can't figure out what this would be.
Yeah.
I was thinking, like, have they all been, like, voices in, like, Marvel things or something, or just...
The Van Damme one's a little bit tenuous because JCVD, he sort of plays himself but in a narrative form, but he does this amazing monologue in the middle of the film in which he recounts his career and his thoughts on where he's been. And, yeah, it's a pretty amazing film, actually, JCVD, if you haven't watched it. So, yes, they were all in mockumentaries.
Yeah, all right. Anyway, let's wind this thing out.
Sign us off.
Let's do it. Folks, this has been Screen Watching. If you're interested in my work, you can find it at alwaysbewatching.com. This is a daily newsletter where you get updates about the latest things that are happening on screens, big and small.
All the Screen Watching socials are alive and active. Once again, at Screen Watching Podcast for Facebook. On X, we're at @screen_watching. YouTube is just Screen Watching. And you can email us at screenwatchingpodcast@gmail.com. I should have put an L in there, @gmail.com. And see some of my works at screen-space.net.
Are we on Threads?
I don't think we are on Threads at the moment. Is that worth getting going? Is that going to be a thing?
I think it feels like it's becoming a thing this week.
All right. Yes. Well, I answered one of your threads during the week. So is that what it's called? I'm just following what the kids say. So, okay, maybe we will get a threads thing happening in the weeks ahead. So
we'll see how that goes. Yeah. Anyway, folks, this has been Screen Watching. My name, Dan Barrett, joined by...
Simon Foster back in the chair and loving every minute of it. Good episode, Dan. Well played.
Excellent. We have a whole bunch of really interesting movies and TV shows in the weeks ahead. I know this because I've seen a whole bunch of them and I can't talk about them yet.
And having been away for 3 weeks, I've seen none of them, and I still haven't seen The Creator. I still haven't seen The Exorcist Believer. So that's why some of the reviews haven't quite sort of hit the The Exorcist Believer is getting some savaging on the internet and from critics everywhere. I think it's at like 19% on Rotten Tomatoes. So it's getting butchering.
My health was kind of holding up on a Tuesday, and I thought, I'm going to get along and see The Exorcist Believer. And then by the end of that afternoon, I was like, nah, can't do it. Too unwell. Don't want to make other people sick. Opted not to go. And then I started looking at the reviews come through the next morning, and boy, oh boy, did that maintain my health in a way that...
Bullet dodged.
Yeah. Brutal.
All right, mate. We'll talk next week.